بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. So I think we went to ayah number. I'm following the count of, as I said, Duri, this ayah number 21, which is الذي جعلكم الأرض فراشا والسماء بناء وأنزل من السماء ماء فأخرج به من الثمرات رزقا لكم فلا تجعل لها أندادا. Now we discussed this, but just a side note. The previous ayah, worship your Lord who created you and those before you, so that you may ward evil, you may avoid hellfire, ward every evil. That was the translation of Pictar, which is the better one. Would have been enough to introduce who is the one who created you, or the one before you. Must be by necessity of reason and pondering, must be the one who created everything else. But the ayah after that, extend that and add more aspects to this. And the person that is not only to address reason, but also this reason obviously is addressed always, but to address also the heart, the feelings. The next ayah does it says, "Allah جَعَلَ لَكُمُ الْأَرْضَ," who made the earth for you, like submissive or leveled, or firash. Firash is like a bed. It's a bed. You can walk on it. You can live on it. You can act on it, etc. وَالسَّمَاءَ بِنَاءً, and the heaven, a structure or a building. And we discussed that this is also hinted that Sama here means the upper atmosphere, obviously, because Sama is anything above you. Could be sometimes the atmosphere is meant, sometimes the external universe with the stars and the galaxies, etc. So Sama is always above your head. Or taking that the earth is round, and if you go through to the center of the earth, the center of the earth is below your feet. You should not be thinking that you can go through to the other side and then the Sama would be below you, because the center is really center of gravity. So the what's below you is the center of the earth. And the Sama is above you, even if part of the Sama is on the other side, it's still above you, because it's the opposite direction to the center of the earth. But that's not our point. Our point is that they say, you don't say this created the earth, because that has been finished in the previous ayah, made the earth for you. So it has been not only created in any way, but created such a way that it is suitable for human beings to dwell on it, and the Sama as a structure or a protective. In another ayah, say Saqfan Mahfuzan, Saqfan Mahfuzan, a protected ceiling. And some idiots in time past, idiots is abound also in our time now, say, but there's no ceiling, really, there's no hard ceiling. That's the way the people think. And the people do not understand that that the word ceiling meaning something should protect you from the top. It doesn't need to be like structure out of steel or wood. It could be very, very well like a magnetic field. The magnetic field which protects us from radiation and the vector radiation, most of the radiation into space, very little comes through. That's number one. Secondly, the fact that that we have the atmosphere, and the upper atmosphere is also is as hard for high-speed meteorites as a tough ceiling. The meteorites burn there on collision with the atmosphere, so it is a protective ceiling. But people sometimes, they think, when you say protected ceiling, it must be like the ceiling of a house. But now, as the Arabic saying, لكل داء دواء نصف طبوي إلا الحماقة للحماقة آية من يداويها. For every disease there is a medication or a cure or a remedy except stupidity. You have difficulty curing the stupidity. So if someone is so stupid, do not understand the general meaning what a ceiling's function is, and I can't call something which protect me from top as a ceiling. Just give an example that it's part of the natural human being, human nature. Like, for example, when the Israelis talk about the so-called Iron Dome, that they have a protected Iron Dome. Obviously, the Iron Dome tend to be quite permissive, not that iron as they imagine, because of the Patriot system. There's no dome. They mean there's a protective distance in which nothing can penetrate. Obviously, this is nonsense. It has been penetrated many times with many things, but that's what they said. So, if someone thinks that they're talking about the Iron Dome protecting Israel from foreign missiles and so on, is some kind of a dome like the dome on top of the grave of the Prophet or the dome in Hagia Sophia, then only what can we say? Sayyidina Lillahi wa Inna Ilayhi Raji'un. We cannot talk very, very much with idiots and stupid guys. That's it. This is a natural expression in the language that anything in the top which is like a dome shaped or could be imagined as can be called a dome, can be called a ceiling. Anyway, that's just a side remark. So here, the Earth and this, and we know this has been fixed. Actually, all these facilities that it will develop in this way in the proper time has been fixed by choosing the initial parameters at the moment of the beginning of time, in the Big Bang, or even if it's not a Big Bang, whatever it was, the moment of zero moment. Let's say zero moment of creation, which is there is by just a side remark. There are quite a number of mathematical conclusions and theoretical theorems actually proven with mathematical rigor that a universe which behaves similarly to ours in matter of expansion and so on must go back to a singularity. The singularity is unavoidable, which is by necessity, because coming out of non-existence to existence is highly singular, is an essential singularity. For those who have mathematical background, they know the difference between essential singularity and a polar singularity. This is an essential singularity, infinitely multiply complex, an essential singularity. That has been fixed so that the Earth will be suitable. The universe have been fashioned with these initial parameters, so it will be suitable in due course, in due time. How many billions years later, we don't know. If the universe, the current estimate is 13.5 or 13.6 or 4, so billions years, and the Earth is something like 4.5 billion years, and maybe the Sun half a billion or something older. So the Sun is actually a third generation star. But all these initial parameters were chosen so that this development will be ultimately ending at least with one Earth. We don't know if there are other Earths in the universe. There may be billions of Earths similar with other creatures. And there's a hint in the Quran in some place that there may be other creatures which are material and have heavy weight, which can be called Dawab, because there's an ayah which says, وَلِلَّهِ يَسْجُدُ مَنْ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ من دابة والملائكة. Normally the Quran will say الله يسجد من سماوات الأرض. It should have been said الملائكة ودابة. Yeah? Because سماوات, usually we imagine angels allocated to سماوات, and أرض دابة. دابة means a being which is material and heavy, which when it walks, it will dip, dip, dip because of the weight. But the next part of the ayah, instead of saying الله يسجد من فيه, for Allah prostrate everything in heavens and earth, it doesn't start with the malaika, which belong to the first one, the heavens, and the dabba, the wab, which is the earth. It starts with the min dabba wal malaika, which is a hint that even in samawat, there are dabbas. There are heavy beings out of the usual matter we know, maybe with a quite different structure, but with the matter we know. So if there are other earths in other galaxies, how many are those? There's maybe only one in the whole universe. Someone said also, if it is only one, say this is a big waste, that the whole universe is created for this one. That's not a waste, because this is, again, it's very difficult really to deal with stupidity. And because the universe could not develop and be well-balanced unless at this appropriate mass and this appropriate, and chosen such a way that at least one Earth, and if it is chosen so that only one Earth emerged, that's fine. That's no problem. It's depending upon the initial choice. But it could be many Earths. And this ayah gives a hint, a faraway hint, just finger pointing without clarifying. Anyway, mentioning that is not to enforce that he is the one that created that, but to enforce that this has been anticipated and made for you to be suitable. You should be thankful for that. You should be thankful that you exist, that you are conscious. However, how this consciousness has been achieved. We will come to the story of Adam and the usual big battle between evolutionary creationists and evolutionists. This is a fake battle. There's no battle there. It doesn't make any difference if Adam is created in 1 second or it's created over 4 billion years. It's the same. It is the same creator. He's created, because the whole universe is created and the initial parameter is chosen this way. But we'll discuss that a little bit more, because this seems to be a topic where some people get like almost like an allergic reaction and heart irregularity and so on, thinking the world is collapsing. That's nothing there, is that? This is all imagination and all is based on a fake assumptions and fake understanding of the ayahs and the revelation. But anyway, whatever, it's one earth or many earths, for us here, we should be appreciating, not only recognizing that this is the creator who fixed this way, but it should be appreciated. So, because you should appreciate that this has been fashioned this way, and from And from this, now from heaven, from Sama, from above, that is the above. Sama is above because we know the water comes from above, from the clouds, from even essentially lower levels of the atmosphere. There are external levels of atmosphere which barely have any water. So the water comes from heavens, which have actually originally been evaporated from the oceans. And even before the earth became solid, All of the water was clear, except that one which is trapped in the chemical structure of the rocks or the molten lava. The rest was clearly the atmosphere was completely saturated with water, just essentially water vapor, and barely any oxygen, and so that developed later. So whatever it is, that water which comes also has the system has been so fixed and chosen that this water will come, and through that water, fruits and bare sustenance have been created for you. Yeah. So you should be appreciating. It's not only recognizing it happened by the previous eye, essentially, and necessity of reason. He is the creator of all of this and the initiator of all of this. And he's the one who kickstarted this way deliberately, knowingly that it will develop this way. It didn't happen just accidentally and was a great accident. No, it's not like that. It has been chosen so that it becomes this way that is today. In the general structure, obviously, and the general features of the universe. So if that's so, you should at least be appreciating. You should not appoint masters and lords beside Allah, being it like kings and rulers who are given the right of sovereignty, and they can enact any laws they would like. These are the lords beside Allah. They are made equal to Allah in sovereignty, which is the worst thing you could imagine. Or entities of your imagination, which do not exist in reality, which sometimes represented by idols and so on, which are supposed to have some kind of function in the universe, either modeling the universe or creating part of the universe or something like that. So don't appoint to Allah any undead, because this will be not appreciating for that, what the one who did that all for you exclusively. And these undeads, especially if we're talking about tyrants and kings and so on, who have the attribute to themselves as a sovereignty and the right of making laws and defining good and evil, and thus becoming the supreme lord, they did not do nothing of that. Absolutely nothing. They have no contribution to that. So how can you appreciate them by appointing them, giving them this rank, while the one who deserves that rank are not aware? So it's addressing the emotions, the feeling of being appreciative and thankful, which is a part of good behavior of a knowledgeable being. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is appreciating, if you good deed, he's appreciate that, because this is a part of being haqq. Haqq is that to appreciate that if someone contributes something, even if his contribution is minimal, like human beings, their contribution is based on what Allah has given them of capability and so on, but still they did the free will and they did these good deeds, and Allah is very appreciating of that, because this is a haqq. The non-appreciating for the achievement or doing of anyone who does something is a sign of internal deficiency, a sign of insecurity. A perfect being will be appreciating for even the smallest deed. And human beings should be appreciating at least for this important, fundamental making of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the universe, first of all, making them to exist, as in the previous ayah, with these features, with the capability of consciousness and cognition, and then giving all these facilities who share, they recognize he's the one who initiated, could have otherwise. Just a small change in the initial parameter, universe could have been otherwise. Vastly different. A minimal change may be changed, so the earth will be very difficult to live on. Life will be continuous struggle and painful. Reality life is not a continuous struggle and pain. It contains considerable portions of enjoyment and relaxation and so on. Even in the time of hunter-gatherer, they go, for example, for hunting and so on. They're not going 24 hours a day. It's just 1 or 2 days, 2 or 3 hours a day they go, and the rest they are enjoying themselves. They're sitting in caves and making drawings, enjoying life. So it was not like when it was the story of Adam, they were placed in a garden. It's a garden in earth, but we'll discuss that later. And they were enjoying a lot of luxury with little effort, barely any effort. So this should be appreciated. So, and that, well, the first step of appreciation is to acknowledge that he is the only sovereign and the Lord. Not appoint anyone laws beside him or give anyone obedience in principle, as that you deserve obedience by yourself. Nobody deserves obedience by himself except the Supreme Lord, who has these features. So this is, besides addressing the reason, is also addressing the feelings and the perception, the heart. We usually say heart, and but actually qalb, heart in Islam, represent also the conscious feeling reason. It's not opposite to reason. And for example, the subcontinent tradition say, don't use your head or mind, use your heart. There's this dichotomy does not exist in Islam. The heart is really here in the head, but the aspects of feelings and appreciation and all these things are extra to just the mere cognition. But they are based on the cognition, and the cognition is still their core. The core must be the cognition and rationality, but flanked and covered and improved by feelings and associations. So since you know that, you should not assume that. We discussed the ayah, but it's just this aspect. So it is not only, it's not mentioning that for that they've been created. That should be have been concluded easily by rationality of BSA, but that they made this way. This specific characteristics should be appreciated. And if they say, based on that, you should not associate to Allah the partner, because this partner did not do nothing like that. None of that is what they're doing. So why they should be given any respect which they don't deserve? If they deserve respect, Allah will not command you not to respect the one who is respect worthy. Definitely. Like, for example, when the Prophet said, in the ijlalillah, part of glorification and regarding the majesty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is to respect the old gray-haired Muslim, the Shaybat al-Muslim, the one who became gray in Islam. Give him the respect. And respect the just ruler. Just ruler should be respected because he is just. Yes, he could not have been just without Allah's permission, but he did something and became just and controlled his own desires, which tend to make you unjust and to make you oppressive and to make you corrupt. But this just and non-corrupt ruler deserves respect. Not only obedience, that's it, that's a part of the law, but deserves respect. You should feel the respect of this person. And this is by order of Allah. That's part of honoring Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is to honor these and give them the respect. But who give anyone ultimate supremacy? He create nothing. He did not level the earth for you. He did not bring water from heaven. He did do nothing. He's just becoming, maybe user, possibly have usurped power with the sword and forcing himself. How come then you attribute him to any sovereignty or divine rights? This is really extremely unthankful and disrespectful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, so this. Then, after this address to humans, they said that this was to humans, not to all you believe, all human beings, all mankind. It says, but someone could say this address to them from the Quran, and the Quran is brought by Muhammad. Well, Muhammad, who guarantee us that he did not fashion these ayahs and or claim this prophethood, either by deliberately because he's a liar, a deceiver, or by some orientalists in recent days, psychological sciences and psychology developed, say is the so-called internal mind or the subconscious is talking through him because he's struggling in a bad society and he wants to reform society, so he imagined that he's a prophet. He's overwhelmed by this. By corruption around him, he wants to change it, and out of fervor and devotion, without having any evil intention, he believed himself really to be a prophet. So these possibilities are there; these rational possibilities are there. And he's someone who is overtaken by his internal or subconscious, if this subconscious exists in the first place. But assume something like that exists, so overwhelmingly, and he had such a mental capacity and capability that he imagined himself to be, he imagined hearing things. And we know there are mental psychological cases. Some people claim that they're hearing voices and hearing, Allah, I don't know if that's all true or not, but it seems to be, there are too many cases to be discounted as all fabrication and lies of those guys. Definitely some people believe that they're hearing sounds and someone talking to him to do this and do that. So he may be overtaken by his subconscious. We don't need to say necessarily he's mental or have a problem, but he's overtaken. And the third possibility is that he received that, there's also a fourth possibility I will discuss, later, that's received from some kind of another supernatural satanic being. Well, but we discussed that for the moment because he claims he is addressing them in the name of the one who created the universe. Or he's receiving that from supernatural being. So these are three possibilities. So there's some space for doubt. someone addressing you with such a major issue, you could say, maybe he is a prophet. Yeah, that's just, and the address sounds rational and compelling. But it is not, does not prove that he is really, the call is coming from the one who created the universe, the one who is behind space and time. So you may have doubt, or some people may have doubt. Various level of people. Some people may have no doubt even for a fraction of a second, like Waraqa ibn Nawfal, the one with the Prophet, describing what he has. He said, this is the one who came to Moses, because he has some background, and he is a man who was devoted to truth. He himself is a Makki, who was raised up as a pagan, but he perceived that paganism is nonsense and went searching for the truth, and then adopted Christianity. Ultimately, after Judaism, he found Judaism is not sufficiently persuasive, then he adopted Christianity. So with this background, he immediately recognized that this couldn't be possibly anything else. So he has no doubt, or has a doubt for a fraction of a second. Abu Bakr has barely a doubt, because he knows the Prophet ﷺ personally, thoroughly. He had not even a doubt, not even few moments. But Omar had doubt for 6 years. So the people differ in their mental capability, in their way to analyze, and what their background, and so on. So this doubt must be addressed. This is a legitimate doubt. If someone says this is not legitimate, no, it is legitimate. And that's the reason Allah says it. وَإِنْ كُنْتُ فِي رَيْبٍ مَا نَزَلْنَا عَلَى عَبْدٍ. It's addressed to all humanity, not to a single person, to all humanity. But every single person of them, and how they deal with them, because it cannot be dealt with it by a single person. So this one who has a doubt, and hear this address, should look at the doubter and tell, let us join together and do the job. But let's continue with the ayah first. وَإِنْ كُنْتُمْ فِي رَيْبٍ مِّمَّا نَزَّلْنَا عَلَىٰ عَبْدِنَا. If you are doubting that what we have revealed on our slave, Allah uses the Prophet in some places, our messenger, sometimes a slave, depending on the situation. But here, the situation is to stress that he is a slave, that he is a servant, that he is created. This is not a lord. And he's not coming from himself, and he's not making injunctions and laws from his desire. No, he's a pure, he's completely submissive. Because the word abada in Arabic means the clearest example for it is used in the original language. When you say this road is mu'abbad, doesn't mean enslaved, means it's leveled. It is submissive completely. If you walk on it, or if you drive a car on it, you don't feel any humps and bumps. While the road who is not even not leveled, so it's completely flat, completely submissive in the tune that there is nothing in him, nothing of his personality remains visible. It's just flat, just leveled. Tariq al-Mu'abbad, like say, this road, you see some of the mountains, a track, like a trail, the trails where people, for example, those who love to hike in the mountains, they cut away, they will be done away with time. Then you see where the foot had been stepped lentily, the way is more leveled or more even. It's not as even as you have done in asphaltation, definitely, but it's quite leveled compared to the surrounding area where it is humby and the trees and so on. This one, the plants has been removed just by the stepping, continuous stepping, prevent anything from growing, and then you have just relatively leveled. Hada, this is not mu'abbad in the sense of like asphalted roads. This is a high level of mu'abbad, but it's still mu'abbad compared to the surrounding hilly mountain. So this abd comes from that. Does not mean there is not, and also even abd in the sense of Arabic language and Sharia is not like the chattel slavery in the West. But we'll discuss that when we come to what's the meaning of slavery in Islam, and which is more accurately could be called bondsman or lifelong servantship or something like that. Anyway, that's not the issue here. But ala abdina, so to stress that he's abd, he's not a rab, he's not a lord. So if you are doubting, including the previous ayahs, the call to you, this man has come with a Quran. Now this revelation has happened in Naili Medina. Before that, about 70% of the Quran has been in Mecca. So considerable numbers of surah and ayahs and things and prophecies and many things has been revealed. And quite a number of surah, maybe 70% of the surahs, maybe even more, because the Madani surah number-wise, maybe volume size-wise, they are 30% of the Quran. But number-wise, they're much less in number, because most of the surahs are Makki. Because look at Juz Amma, how many surahs are there, and all of them are essentially Makkis. All short, 2 or 3 lines, 4 lines, 1 line, even One solar is almost only 3 hours, and one and a half line in the usual hand, it's a reasonable handwriting, the standard one we have. So he has brought not only this ayah, he has brought plenty of ayahs before. And even after the revelation was closed, people addressed this addresses not to the people only at that time. Yes, it addressed the people at that time when it was revealed in the early Medina, especially the address was to the Jews specifically, but to all mankind. But it's for everyone after them and after the death of the Prophet and the first generation, second generation, until today, until tomorrow, addressing everyone. And the Quran is in our hand, it's called protected, and all issues about the protection of the Quran, which time it was written, has been all refuted now and set to rest. From day one, actually, but people came forward, and every time new evidences come, refuting them and putting them at the side. But so there's little disagreement by anyone who accept the most stupid, which you cannot cure. The stupidity is no cure, which even argue about the necessity of a perception and reason. There's nothing to do. You just tell this person to go back and look in the mirror and think again about his own existence, if he is really sure about his own existence. We exclude this type. All others, majority of human beings, are sufficiently reasonable to recognize that the Quran comes from Muhammad. Only the issue is that, is it from not from, from himself, either to roots, deliberately or undeliberately, or from another source outside himself. And then we go to the other theory outside himself, a satanic entity and so on, which has been argued by some Christian. So this is the Quran is in your hand, is arguing with the Quran. So bring one surah like that, like the Quran. And it doesn't specify any surah, so we can go to the smallest surah. But not only that, the challenge is much stronger. وَدْعُوا شُهَدَاءَكُمْ مِنْ دُونِ اللَّهِ إِنْ كُنْتُمْ Ask all your witnesses who witness that this is fabricated and so on and claim otherwise. Let them come together and work with you together. Your witnesses, because there must be someone witnessing that. The witnessing, because the Quran is in hand. I read it really. There's a blatant error here which we can expose and show this an error. Or here is a blatant linguistic mistake which we can expose. Or here is a lack of eloquence which we can expose, depending upon what you look at, what's the miraculous nature of the Quran. So call over them if you are telling the truth, that your doubt is justified. So bring surah and bring all your witnesses who witness that the surah is equivalent if you are telling the truth. فَإِنْ لَمْ تَفْعَلُ If you don't do, and now the amazing sentence of the dead, وَلَنْ تَفْعَلُوا لَنْ in Arabic means for the future, لَنْ يَحْصُلْ هَذَا This will never happen. لَنْ means not for the future, but not ever. لَنْ تَفْعَلُوا You will never do. And this is also a challenge of the Quran. A challenge you can't do and you will never do. You will never be able to do. So, if you cannot do, and you will never, and I assure you, Quran says, I assure you that you will never be able to do, then protect yourself from then, now this the threat of the hellfire. Now you have rejected something, which the evidence, the compelling evidence is talking for, positive for, and you have decided not to, to submit to this evidence. فَاتَّقُوا النَّارِ Protect yourself from the hellfire. What is this hellfire? Which is inflamed or is fueled by men and stones. And this fire has been prepared for the disbeliever, for kafirin. Kafirin here in the genuine original sense, for the one who reject the truth after the evidence have come to them. So that kafirin, you will be then from these kafirin who have seen the truth and failed to refute it. Because accordingly, you were challenged. You did not bring anything forward. And all your witnesses, you could not get witnesses to witness for that what you did, that it is really equal or similar to the Quran. In all aspects, we'll discuss what aspects that, maybe a small discussion. And then you have rejected the truth against evidence. That's rejecting the truth against evidence. In the case of Sarujus coming from Allah, religious truth, that's the meaning of religious here, meaning coming from revelation from Allah, then this is what is defined by Sharia as kufr. And that's what will end with the one who is doing that into the hellfire. That's the genuine kufr, which ending in the hellfire. It's not the kufr in the sharia of classifying people in dunya, the people who do not know that Muhammad is a messenger, or having seen no evidence, or living in the Amazon. They are not Muslim, so technically, they are not mu'min, if you wish to use the dichotomy in one of the surah of the Quran. If they are not mu'min, they are done kafir. They are kafir in the sense that they did not receive the truth and they don't witness for the truth, not because they rejected it, but because they are not aware about it. In that sense, it's kafir. But it has nothing to do with any repercussion with the hellfire or the akhirah. So the word kafir could be used in various things. Usually when the Quran talks about kafir, generally, it is those who have rejected the truth and who received the evidence and they decided to reject it for whatever reason. After that, he gives good news for those who believe. So beside the threat, there is good news for the believer to encourage, because there must be side threatening people if they don't comply with the truth and respond to the call. So I am your Lord calling you to this call. You have rejected the hellfire, but if you accept it, it's not free of charge. If you accept, there will be some reward. But before we go there, there's one additional possibility, which had been said by some, actually by Bush Senior, his grandfather is a famous missionary, and he wrote, I don't have, unfortunately, at the moment where he wrote, but it can be traced easily and so on, that true, Muhammad is a revelation. The claim that he is fabricating deliberately is not true. All his life showed that he is devoted to that body, and that he is moved by his subconscious is nonsense. That's not possible. But actually, what he is receiving is from the devil, who is fighting Christ, because he is denying the truth of Christ being the Son of God, or let us say maybe the truth of Christ being the Messiah, being Christ. But for this guy, is the Son of God. I think that's what he regarded as what motivated the devil. But the problem with this kind of argument is clearly is that if Allah allows someone to bring such a devastation for Christianity, which Islam is definitely the Christianity which believe in the divinity of Christ, not the original Christianity, which we may argue what really Christ has brought, what was really his message, what happened really in his life, because we don't have a clear, well-established picture, even with the existing material, is not sufficient to have gain a picture. And there is sufficient many contradictions, which obviously led to the complete collapse of Christianity in intellectual circles in general, and the people withdraw from it. Even the one who committed to Christianity, for example, like philosophers and thinkers of weight, Kierkegaard, for example, said, "I believe because it's impossible." So he believes because it's impossible. He believes, he genuinely said this term, "I believe because it's impossible to believe." Because obviously he could not find anything to find internal peace except to find belief in something. And the only thing which is available to him, somebody could blame him, why didn't you look elsewhere? But it's another issue. He did not look elsewhere. So the only thing was on the table from his background, from his childhood and so on. He's also an existentialist and one of the believing Christian existentialists. So he believed in the divinity, etc., because it's impossible. So how come that Allah allows someone challenging like that and the devil pretending to be in his? This means really essentially that this Bush great-grandfather or Bush grandfather is essentially himself is really a heretic. He's essentially ascribing to the heresy of Marcion. Marcion has the following heresy, is that the crucifixion of Jesus and the coming of the Son was necessary to penetrate through the devil who controls this world. And the devil, all previous revelations, including the Old Testament, is from the devil. This was too much for the early Christian and the early church, so declared him to be a kafir and heretic. And you cannot blame them. This is so extreme. Obviously, disregarding the irrationality of that, if that's true, meaning Allah was not able to penetrate or defeat the devil or break through the devil except by sacrificing his own son, meaning the devil is a divine entity. Then we have two divine entities. If they're two divine entities, by necessity of reason, they will be equal in power. So, and because they, since they are completely opposed, meaning they couldn't be possibly have in, be in a creation or in an Adam creation, anything in the first place. The devil would have undermined the creation of Adam from moment zero. Could not have let it go. That's not possible. That's not the way divine beings work. So, well, that's besides contradict the necessity of reason that a necessarily existing being, there's only one. Maximum one. There couldn't be two beings. That's impossible. So it contradicts all rationality, all principles of reason, and will undermine reason before undermining any religion in the first place. So the claim that this is really a revelation is not from Muhammad can't be, because he said this is what he has brought us. It's impossible for him, for an illiterate man in the desert to bring that. It's out of question. The man is, at least in this point, he's fair. That's out of question. It's absurd to claim that his subconscious, even if the subconscious is working there and compelling him to claim to be a prophet, the subconscious will not be able to produce all these historic facts and this information and this correction to the Old Testament and all this. That's out of question. That's not again. It must be something, some supernatural being, but it's the devil who is an enemy of Christ or to undermine. So instead of coming to the correct conclusion, that is actually not the devil. Your belief in the divinity of Christ is wrong, based on a possible assumption which has no fundamental evidence for itself and rational compelling evidence. So he's put a belief in something which is not proven by certitude of reason ahead of something which certitude of reason dictate, and to take the escape route to go to the devil and make the universe a battleground of two divine beings which impossible to justify rationally. It will collapse. It will lead to collapse of reason. It's the old issue of Qadr and also how the evil come in the universe. But the solution of two divine beings that one can confront Allah and undermine his work, this is impossible, because it leads to two opposing deities which no creation can happen. I mean, besides, it's opposed to the necessity of reason that a necessarily existing being is only one. It cannot be two. So this is the third escape route. The Quran does not address that really, because this is such a singular point of view, so obviously blatantly absurd. Only very few twisted minds will ponder on that. But it has been Marcion has expressed that in time past, and currently this Bush great grandfather expressed it, and other will express it in the future also. You can't exclude that. There will be always some minds which are twisted. Just a footnote about also such kind of arguments. One of the current missionaries, still I think alive, was and he's refuted by other missionaries who embraced Islam. He said the evidence that Islam is not true is that John, so he referred to a scripture which is not even well established with certitude that it's coming from John the disciple, one supposed to be one of the disciples of Christ. He's saying whoever do not believe that Christ the Son of God be cursed in all eternities. That's what he says. So first of all, he refers to a scripture which is not well established. You cannot establish it with certitude. That's number one. Secondly, he misquotes or even lies bluntly, because what John said, whoever doesn't believe that Jesus is the Christ, is the Messiah, be cursed on all eternity. And Islam is saying with the loudest voice that Jesus is the Messiah. So it cannot apply to Islam. So sometimes you have to deal with some jokers here and there, but the best thing is to deal with it mercifully and casually, not to indulge very much in such extremely irrational and stupid things. But the two first possibilities, that he is deliberately claiming to be a prophet, knowing that he is not, that's refuted by all his life and his behavior. That's no doubt about that. Remains only the subconscious issue. The subconscious issue is refuted also by Bush, the grandfather, saying that what he brought about the Old Testament is impossible for someone in Mecca literate to know. So subconscious or no subconscious, it doesn't matter. He has to get it somewhere. Where did he get it? It's impossible to get it from subconscious by itself, creating ex nihilo. That's out of question. That's rationally impossible. So it must be from some source. But he placed the sauce in the wrong place, in the devil. So that's it. So what's the challenge? Now the scholars through all through history were going back and forth. What is the challenge? Bring one surah like it. It appears that the first point of challenge, because it's addressed in the first instance to the Arabs, but addressed to all humanity, I said, to the Arabs, is that the miraculous nature of the Quran manifests itself directly for Arabs in its eloquence. So that, because they are essentially an oral nation, they have barely in a written culture, and their old culture relies on poetry over its subtypes and eloquent speech, like some sermons. They have sermons for Qusay bin Sa'd al-Iyadi, some maverick personalities coming in the Hajj and admonishing the people about the hellfire, other people coming and telling long stories. Another one, for example, one Qurayshi leader, I will get his name in a few seconds, inshallah. He said, Muhammad, tell you the stories about the Prophet in time past. We are certainly not sure these stories have any historic value, but I tell you even nicer, better stories. I will tell you stories of Kisra and Qaisar and Sfandiyar and the recent history, which we know it is true. And he framed that nicely and gave it to two slave girls, possibly in poetry form, which were making songs and singing with that. So he thought that he was be able to undermine the message. Not he was not intending to challenge the Quran. He knows himself and his language better than that. But he was intending to say, I can bring a better message, something at least more practical. You see what's going in the Persian Empire, possibly because the Kisra Abrawiz, the Kisra of the time of Prophet Islam, until he was killed later in the time of Prophet, and even he was before that for decades. This one has a famous love story. What's her name, Yasmin or Nasreen? It's a famous love story. So that love story fits nicely in poetry. And you could do nice poetry with love story of Kisra Abrawiz or Barviz. This Barviz is coming from Abrawiz. So an interesting story. You could make songs around that and so on and get the people enjoying it, listening to it, etc. So he thought this way, we may be able to get the people to listen to more enjoyable stories than Muhammad's stories. Yeah? But this is not... but as I said, that's all what they have. Essentially an oral culture, which is relies mostly on poetry and some prosa. Usually short prosa, like ceremonies, like a tribal chieftain instigating to war. You know, this tribe has done that and that, and you are the sons of so and so on, and et cetera, et cetera. And that, no more than these people are not. We don't have the television at that time, and we don't have people who are trained to talk several hours like nowadays. They talked only for 2-3 minutes. That's all that they talk. They never give long sermons. So that's all they give, like half a page or something at the best of them. Obviously, some of it has been lost when the narrators narrate that this man in this occasion gave that speech. We can assume that some of the speech has been lost, but it cannot be 95% had been lost and only 5% had been conserved. Maybe half, 2/3, and the Arab are trained, very well trained in memorizing, because they don't have they have barely writer, and if you don't have barely writer, you are forced to memorize, and they were dedicated people who are narrates and with excellent memory. So we can assume at least we have half of the sermon or 2/3 of that sermon, meaning it cannot be more than one page. So that's what we have, pieces of one page. And plenty of that has been recorded in the Arab literature, the Arabic language. Actually, that's recorded much earlier even the recordation, the formal recording, formal and scholarly recordation of hadith. There is a non-formal recordation. Every Sahabi and every Tabi'i recorded his own manuscripts, which is also written. So the claim that all this hadith is purely oral is. Let me just make a small note. When they say this is an oral tradition, some Orientalists or some people, meaning it's purely oral, it was not written down. That's a mistake. That's not what they mean, actually. The respectable scholars of the West, they don't mean with that. They mean it is not in a publicly publicized books, publicized to the public and acknowledged by everyone to be a reference book. That's what they mean, oral. Oral is not that it's just purely oral, that you attend to your sheikh and listen from him orally. You don't write anything. They don't mean that. And the reality is that the so-called oral tradition is oral in that sense, that it is not in officially publicized, widely circulated books, which you can refer to, that's the collection of so on and so on. That's one. That everyone has his own private collection. Although Ibn Abbas have several books, but they were more or less private. And people were copying from it, but it was not available for sale from a public place, like a bookshop or something like that, or available for distribution from people who are devoted for writing, like, for example, the written documents of the Jews and Christians, for example, the current Gospels. We know that they have written roots going maybe up to the end of the first century. Before that, it comes to oral tradition. Does not mean oral tradition is only just oral and hearsay. It may be written, but no documents available and were not in the hand of the public. And the Jews claim they have an oral tradition from Musa, which they claim it is enshrined in the Talmud, in the teachings. It may be true, but it cannot be oral, just orally like that. It'd be just private from teacher to student. It is not books which are available for the public, like the books which they have, the famous books in the Old Testament. So the Arab did not have much of written tradition scattered, but before even the recordation of the Sunnah formally in books, which had happened in the second century. Again, I just mentioned that quickly to refute, just a footnote, to refute the general claim you find everywhere that the Sunnah has been recorded only in the third century, Bukhari and so on. These people do not know. They're blubbering what they don't know. There are already books, complete books, which have been available public everywhere since the early second century, starting with the Sahifa of one of the students of Abu Huraira, not Zayd ibn Wahab, another one. Anyway, that Sahifa is available, even physically is available in a museum in Egypt. And the whole Sahifa is absorbed with all its narrations in Musnad Ahmad, total Sahifa. And if you check the Sahifa, and you check what in Musnad Ahmad, they fit exactly letter by letter, which shows that the narrators between the Sahiba, they were copying, because whatever memory be excellent, you may miss a letter. So there's not even missing one letter, not even one dot. So it has been copied generation after generation. So that Sahifa was public. Hammam ibn Munabbih, that's the name of the student. This is Hammam and Wahab ibn Munabbih, two brothers. Wahab is the older one and the more respected one and more scholarly one, but Hammam was a devoted student of Abu Huraira, and he says, "Haddathana Abu Huraira, qala Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam." Haddathana Abu Huraira, that's the way. And the Sahifa is well known in that order, and it's available even on papyrus before even paper was became prevalent, because paper came later prevalent. So that's just a footnote, since we are in that occasion. Really, we have publicly available books in that sense, people copying from it, and it's in the hand of the people since the late first century, early second century. So Hammam ibn Munabbih died something like 130 Hijri, 130, on high age, if I'm not mistaken. He lived quite a long life, so he died something, because Abu Huraira died 58 Hijri. Hammam to attend his classes and write something for him and learn something from him, he must have been like at least 15, 18 years. So he must have been born like the year 40. If he lives until the year 130, meaning he died over 90 years old, a bit now over the 90, which is rare, but it's available. Many narrators are known to have lived 90, even 100 years. So that's Hammam. If I'm not mistaken, he maybe died earlier, but this is what's in my mind at the moment. His older brother Wahab died much earlier, in the late first century or early second century. So we have these just to refute that. Actually, the collection of the Arabic language and the words and poetry happened much earlier. And even genealogy and so on is much earlier. Even there's a famous genealogy book which has been composed at the time of Muawiyah. So around 55, something like Hijri. And they were in the hand of the people and they were copying from it. So that's genealogy and ansab, these tribes from this tribe and so on. So this is the Arab culture, genealogy, small sermons, poetry, plenty of poetry. If you look at this, and they were devoted to poetry, and they were analyzing poetry, and they were even having competition in Uqab, and they have a judge who judges who is more eloquent and more compelling, etc. So it's an oral narration of prose and poetry. So definitely the linguistic aspect of the Quran is challenging to them, but they failed to respond to the challenge. Now the later mutakallimin, the one who what usually translated as theology, the people of Lahut in the West, the science of defending the religion is called theology, the religion of God, or the things of it. Ilmul kalam in Islam is wider than theology, but let us call the theologian mutakallimin, those of ilmul kalam. They discussed is that because Quran in itself is mu'jiz, it's impossible to bring something similar, or it is because it may be possible, but Allah undermined their capability of bringing something similar or similar surah. So I think this is the discussion, and there was even two extreme points of view. Some people accuse the other side of being mubtadi and heretic. I think this is a mute point. Why it is mute? Because if it is impossible to imitate in itself because of its composition and structure, which I'm inclined to that say, it has exhausted whatever the Arabic language can do. That's okay. That's the challenge is valid. Or if it is Allah took on him that anyone who attempt to imitate the Quran will fail and become a disgrace, that's also miraculous. Either way. It's either way. So this one is miraculous, this one is miraculous. There's no need to be really indulge in excessive argumentation and philosophical discourse about which kind of miracle nature of the Quran, what is the challenge, is it intrinsically in itself? My feeling is like, for example, if you look, for example, one of the shortest surah, the shortest is إِنَّا أَعْطَيْنَكَ الْكَوْثَرَ فَصَلِّ لِرَبِّكَ وَانْحَرْ إِنَّ شَالِكَ وَالْأَبْتَرَ. If you look at this surah, for example, this is challenging until now. What is there? There seem to be normal words, nothing special, no exciting words there out of the ordinary. But if you look at it closer, it addresses a wide topic in the shortest possible way. In such a way, you have difficulty addressing any as many topics in such a short time. For example, that was a response to when the last son of the Prophet in Mecca, because he got a son in Medina, Ibrahim, who died also early. Because we'll discuss Ibrahim another time. Leave it now. I wanted to make a footnote there, but leave it. Then the Quraysh were jubilant because this is a patriarchal society, and if you don't have male sons, then your memory and your history will be extinct. Nobody will inherit your virtues and your glory if you have any glory, and your kingdom if you are a king, or money if you are a money. Only girls, and the girls are at the time were regarded as almost half slaves. So they enslaved by their father and later on sold or enslaved by their husband, who usually will consummate their wealth. That's it. And even the dowry was just really a gift or like price given to the father. She has nothing. So Muhammad is old. His last son died. Only girls are left. So he is abtar. Abtar. Literally meaning his tail is cut. And if you cut the tail of an animal, one time you were searching for your camel and said, who says, so my camel, describe the camel. Actually, for some reason or for an accident, his tail was cut. It's abtar. This is very rare in animals because the Arabs did not have the tradition to cut the tails of as a kind of. Sometimes they may do something like such a mutilation for certain idols, but it is an abtar. His tail is cut, meaning he will leave no trace. He will get extinct. The moment he dies, خلاص. All his memory and all his, because girls will be married to another man, and finish. Nah, nobody will carry his message or his claims or his glory or his whatever he was intending to achieve by this message. Is abtar. So the Quran answered to them. First of all, pacifying his mind, because the fact that the boys are dying and the girls are remaining is painful. Generally, kids are dying, but why specifically boys are dying in a society which is as patriarchic and as male-oriented and male-dominated like the Arab society? How come that this is happening to me? As a human being, you will feel some pain for this. So the ayah starts here, إِنَّا أَعْطَيْنَاكَ الْكَوْثَرْ. We did give you the extreme plenty, not كثير, كوثر. People read, obviously, in various tafatir that Kawthar is also a river in paradise given to Allah. Maybe. That's maybe. That's not. But the Kawthar, he's come from Kathir. We gave you a plenty. And one of the interpretation, based on the Prophet's narration, but this is later. This is obviously not to be addressing the Mushrikeen. The Mushrikeen addressed to the Arabic language. They don't know about paradise and Kawthar yet. In أَعْطَيْنَكَ الْكَوْثَرْ. We gave you multitude. This is an exaggeration form of from Kathir. More, much more than the ultimate more plenty, Kawthar. And you will find barely in the Arabic literature, Arabic poetry, this kind of derivation. You had Kathir, Mukthirin, but you don't find Kawthar. Is this, and the only place in the Quran you find Kawthar, in Atak al Kawthar, not al Kathir, al Kawthar. So, based on that we gave you, don't worry about what we have taken, but what we gave you is so overwhelming, so plenty. So worship your, so perform prayer for your Lord and sacrifice for him. فَصَلِّ لِرَبِّكَ وَانْحَرْ. Perform these rituals. Then it concludes telling him a fact which is not clear at that moment. إِنَّ شَانِئَكَ هُوَ الْأَبْتَدْ. Those who are hating you, شَانِئَ is the one who can extremely hate you, they are the one who will be cut. Cut in the real sense. They will have no memory, history will not remember them. They will be gone. They will be defeated. They will leave no trace. They will never get to any significant change in the world, which will keep any good memory of them. They will be gone. They are the one after, even if they have tons of boys and children. But also behind the scene for us now. So in all these aspects are addressed in three sentences. Each sentence is extremely short. Inna a'tainaka al-kawthar. Indeed, we gave you a plentitude. So, continue praying to your Lord and sacrificing. Continue. This, you should continue in that. In appreciation and deserve. Not only in compliance to the command as a believer, because the Prophet is the first believer and the leader of the believers, and all commands to him are command to everyone. So, respond to that kawthar, in addition of the command to pray and sacrifice. Continue on that. فَصَلِّ لِرَبِّكَ وَانْحَرْ. And we can discuss why he chose these two things. Salah and Nahr. Salah and Nahr. Salah is clear because the first act you expect for someone to offer to Allah than expressing his servitude is Salah, is prayer. And the first thing which will elevate you internally and get you over the hardship of life is prayer, no doubt about that. Anhar, because it's related to having children and bringing sacrifice for if it's a new child, being it one sheep or two sheep, etc. Continue, and you will get in the future, inshallah, other kids, and you will get the opportunity to do for them the aqiqah, etc. Salli Rabbika wanhar, but also the usual rituals of Nahar in Mina, etc. And then إِنَّ شَانِئَكَ هُوَ الْأَبْطَرُ. So you see, many issues have been covered. And also the issue that the boys are dying has not been addressed. It has been addressed later in Medina. That's, we know that from the background of the Quran later, not from the linguistic part. It had been addressed from Medina. At that time, the Prophet had an adopted son. This adopted son is still alive, which is a hint that this adopted son will not carry, that adoption will be abolished because actually, someone could say he has Zayd ibn Haritha, his adopted son, which was called Zayd ibn Muhammad. So he's not Abtar in that sense. Quran does not answer that. So it's a hint that this adoption will be abolished in Medina. But also, part of that is addressed in Surah Al-Ahzab when he says, مَا كَانَ مُحَمَّدٌ أَبَا أَحَدٍ بِرِجَالِكُمْ. Muhammad is not the father of any one of your men. Men. Not children. Men. So what if he gets children? They will be dying as children because he is the final prophet, and his rank as a prophet and one of the supreme prophets would not be perfect if he dies and his children are out of age without becoming prophets, like in the case of Ismail and Ishaq and Ibrahim. So since he is as equal, maybe superior to Ibrahim and so on, whatever, we are not going to argue whose prophet is better than the other superior. His children, if they are in adult age, they should become prophets after him. But he's the final prophet, so they have to go. Unfortunately, very painful, but it has to. and also indicate that the one who carrying his name cannot be a heir in the proper sense, so he cannot become a prophet, which Zayd ibn Haritha. So adoption has to be abolished. And also another interesting point, how Allah acts in the universe. It should have been clear to the Prophet ﷺ from this ayah that even if he gets children, boy children, they will never come out of age. They will die in his life, most likely. They will even not stay after him. They will die after that. So when he got Ibrahim, and he was very happy and jubilant about Ibrahim, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala prevented him from thinking about this point until Ibrahim passed away. Ibrahim must go. He cannot stay. But back to our issue, to basic issue. So we have essentially one line, three sentences, covering so many issues. It's almost impossible to have so many issues and points covered like that. And also the Quraysh understood that. They understood the Arabic language, they're eloquent, they understand the hints and the meanings and so on, at least a portion of that. Secondly, it is expressed in simple, straightforward words, which everyone understands. Sometimes the eloquence is measured on how many strange words and excessive words you use. But in reality, it is using just everyday's word, like kawthar is derived from kathir, and kathir is one of the standard words which people use almost daily. There's a'tainak, we gave you, give, the verb give, salli, pray, anhar, slaughter. It's a standard word used every day almost. Inna shani'aka wal abtar, the one who hates you, shani'an is used in the Quran frequently, and this is the word which is the one who's devotedly hating. Not only just hate, the one who hates, he hates your gut. This one will be cut. And abtar is a common word at the time. Maybe we are not familiar with it because nobody is using it, but it's quite a standard word at that time. And also the word used by them, so it has to be used against them. So very standard words, no specific, but that's not applied only to this surah, to the whole Quran. If we go to the whole Quran, we'll find the remarkable things. Let us look at the following literary aspect. And we'll conclude with that, with this point. Normally, if you scan the usual speech and writing of common people in every language, it seems to be related to the structure of the brain and the mind. It's not related to the Arabic language specifically. If you scan, you will find essentially about 2,000 words, which are used by most people, average people, to express almost everything. And you find that also certified in some dictionary. Like, for example, I think it's Longmans, he said, we have so many, 30,000, 60,000 words or rules, etc. And we tried in the explanation of every words to restrict ourselves in the 2,000 basic words, which is everyone uses in every situation, and use for newspapers and so on. And these, even the 2,000, are I think listed in one, if I remember correctly, in one of the edition, maybe in every edition of Long. I remember the my Longman edition many years back. I don't have it handy now, somewhere in a store, or it's gone maybe. They listing them for several pages, 2,000. That's 2,000. But this applies almost to every language. It has been that statistic study in every language. There are 2,000 words which express almost everything. What's used usually by newspapers, especially the non-broadsheets. The broadsheets are maybe more sophisticated, but the usual one, it doesn't exceed 2,000. It doesn't exceed 2,000. Normally. People of literature have more words. Like, for example, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, almost any man known for literature and eloquent writing, heavyweight people of literature. I'm not aware about the modern ones. Maybe the standard declined in the modern times with these horror stories, writer and things like that. But maybe they're at the same level because they read and they are wide read, and they need to express more things than the usual things of life, to have some work which is worth of reading, be it serious literature or just stories and romance and things like that. They did statistics, or the scientist of language, they did some statistics, and they found that people of literature, which I acknowledge as the like for example Shakespeare, like Saber, they all, everyone has his own choice, but usually they survive and they come out with about 8,000 to 10,000 words. That's almost in every language, and that's the part of the studies of the language and the structure of the language in human beings and comparative language sciences. With one exception, one famous historic exception, which was surprising for many when they found that, when they scanned the work of Victor Hugo, the famous French, which has the humpback of Notre Dame and so on, famous Victor Hugo, they found that he was using about 60,000 words, which is an oddity. No one else was using. Researching his history and his life, they found out that he was deliberately going to the dictionary and picking up odd words. He was, let's see, he was a fanatic which wants more words and more strange words and odd words and out of the ordinary words. So he was doing that deliberately. The other people of literature, they did not do it deliberately in the time of their life. Maybe in their young years, building their word treasury, yes, you build and you go to dictionary. But later on, they have their own word treasury, they are happy with it, they are satisfied, and this, you can find it in their writing. So that's what you expect. Amazingly, now the Quran is expressing wide topics, from philosophical issues, stories of prophets, creation, legally illegal commandments, moral issues, almost every topic imaginable in a woman's mind. You would expect at face such a book must have the same apply, by the way, for the Old Testament. If you go and scan the various words in the original language, also you'll get 8,000, 10,000, something like that. And also the New Testament, including the epistles of in Greek, because it's in Greek, essentially that's the original language in which is available. The older origins in Aramaic and so on, or Western Aramaic, Syriac, are essentially extinct. The existing Syriac now is essentially translated back from, unfortunately, from Greek. It's not the original ones. So you will find also the same phenomena, same because Paul is also a sophisticated literary man. He may be less than 8,000, but because he's not a man of literature, he's a man of da'wah, but still. So you expect the Quran to be in the same league, maybe like Victor Hugo and so on, but you will get a shock of your life. Account has been done by some Egyptian scholars. I'm trying to verify that also. I'm not relying on the people who claim. They found, yes, if you go to Muhammad Fuad al-Baqi and count the various routes, we have about 2,000 routes. Yes, 2,000 routes, indeed. But most of them are used once or twice. About only 500-600 routes, and the words right from them, like the root qala, he said. All the derivation of that are different words, but let's say the roots, qala, etc. Dahika, it's the basic is used for everything. Command, amara, etc. Qada, these words, qadar, these standard words. If you remove the about 1,500 or 1,000 roots at least, which are used once, and maybe 300-400 roots, which are remove them, you will find they are used once or twice, and maybe in one sentence in the Quran here and there. If you remove these sentences, and then count the rest, and you can't count how many sentences are in the Quran, how many words, which are millions, the remaining is more than 95-97% of the Quran. And that all relies only on about 500 roots, 500 to 600 roots, and maybe like a word derived from them. Each root is maybe having one or two or three derivations, so like 1,000. Like 1,000 words, essentially, from 500 to 1,000 words. But the more statistics and more accurate statistics, I relied on someone to do some work in that direction, and he started it several years ago, and then he's not in contact anymore. I don't know what has happened. Hopefully he's alive and well, still doing the work, because it needs some computer work and some definition and things like that. It is doable, especially now with computers. So it is the opposite of what we expect from eloquent writer. Even if you count what is saying attributed to the Prophet ﷺ, you will find much more words than what used in the Quran. Many more words which are not in the Quran. Plenty, plenty more words. So it's the opposite direction you expect. Common people use 2,000 words. Literally, people use 8 to 10,000, with the exception of Victor Hugo. You expect the Quran to be the same. It's actually in the opposite direction. And the number used is just slightly above the number of symbols which a monkey will understand. A monkey understand. Chimpanzees have been tested and given their symbols, not words, of your symbols or substitute for words. They were able to distinguish up to 500 symbols. So anyone who is a little bit above the level of the monkey will have a good portion of the Quran directly understandable and accessible to him, which is the opposite direction you expect to go, despite the eloquence and the internal music. Secondly, the way the sentences are structured, and sometimes it's similar to what they call saja. And saja in Arabic is a prosa which has like rhymes in the ends and a bit of rhythm. Not a poetic rhythm, but a bit of rhythm. It's called saja. And usually it is artificial. And usually it is the saja of Kohan, of the soothsayer. They usually give you their finding or their claim in a form of saja. Like, for example, one kahina is famous to say it. She said, أخ وتف وجورب وخف. جورب وخف. جورب is the socks, and خف is the socks made out of skin. خف, famous خف, which you can wipe over. They ask her, what is جورب and خف? She did it to rhyme with أخ and تف. That's all. It's just for rhyming. It doesn't make any sense. So what did she squeeze for the meaning of جورب وخف? There's not the جورب وخف, you know. It's not the socks and the خف. It's actually two valleys in the hellfire. Just artificial. To make it rhyme. And also in later Arabic literature, when the Islamic culture started declining after the 5th and 6th and 7th century, some development found place. I don't know what's the root of it, but it developed that it is good and show scholarship if your writing is done in saja. So most writing in the later centuries became so almost disgusting with this artificial saja. So the Quran is, although in many cases he has similar endings, but it's not saja. Clearly, it doesn't have the weight of poetry, the rhythm of the poetry and the so-called weights. It is not. Although one or two ayahs may be analyzed as if it's poetry, but that's not the standard. On the other hand, it's not just a straightforward prosa like that we have from sermons of the Arabs before Islam. So it is a unique style. It's a really unique Quranic style. Unique Quranic style. Not the standard poetry, clearly is not a poetry. That's very clear. Nor, although it has some internal rhyme in various lines. Inna a'tainaka al-kawthar fasalli li rabbika wanhar inna shanika wal abtar. Obviously, you can sing it in a certain way. If you are good at singing, you may be able to give it a certain song and a certain what they call maqamat of musical levels. And also, if you hear it from far away without distinguishing the word by a good reader who knows where to move and to stop, it has a great effect musically. There's one musician in Egypt, a Christian musician. He obviously, you know, in Egypt is a habit of the people to talk Quran loudly. So he was hearing the people in Egypt, they live there. There are city parts which are mostly Christian and others. Dominantly Muslim, but there's a good intermix. There's no really separation or confrontation of any relevance there. He was hearing the Quran from far away, like a neighbor after next neighbor or something like that, made by a good reader who will do the stops and the tajweed properly. And he was astonished about the maqamat and the music of the Quran. And after so many years of listening, I was to say, This kind of maqamat, this must be a great musician who did that, who fashioned that. But he checked, turned out the Prophet is the opposite of any musician or poet. He could not even give any verse of poetry without breaking it. Like, for example, the famous verse from Labid who say, "Ala kullu shay'in ma khala Allah batil." Everything except Allah is vain, is gone, is perish. وكل نعيم لا محالة زائل. The Prophet was not unable to quote it this way. Say, "Ala kullu shay'in ma khala, ala kullu shay'in ma batil ma khala Allah." So he broke the rhythm. Instead of "Ala kullu shay'in ma khala," but say, "Ala kullu shay'in batil ma khala Allah." Broke the rhythm. And Abu Bakr tried to remind him, "Messenger of Allah, it is Ala kullu shay'in ma khala Allah batil." The Prophet showed that he did not like that other one, meaning he doesn't have a musical ear. That's part of his not having a musical ear is a deficiency, but in the case of Islam is a perfection, because he is supposed to be not a poet, nor a musician, nor able to make this Quran. So Allah made him this way, so that so when that Christian knew that that the Prophet was like that, he said, this can't be, this must be from Allah. He's telling the truth, and he embraced Islam, just based on the music of it, hearing from far away, without understanding the meaning of the words. So all of these aspects are there, but the challenge continues today. Now the linguistic aspects is gone. I argue in the book of Tawheed is that that challenge of the linguistic aspect has been addressed to the Arabs, the eloquent Arabs with which the language of the Quran have come, and these eloquent Arabs are extinct. The Arabs you see in the Arab world now, they are not eloquent Arabs. They have dialects. They have essentially, for all practical purposes, that these dialects are essentially another language. You can declare that another language. If one of the eloquent Arab will come alive and is faced with one talking the Najdi dialect or the Egyptian, or the worst, the Egyptian dialect, and also the Algerian dialect. But the Algerian dialect is the worst because it has intermixed plenty of French words, but also the pronunciation is quite troublesome. If you face with him, the first 1 or 2 hours, he will not understand anything. The same way you face someone who speaks Spanish with someone who speaks Portuguese. Or if you get a Latin, someone from the Latins revived from the grave and confront him with someone from Italy, he will not understand. Although Italian is obviously the continuation of the Latin. So although someone could argue that the Arab dialects did not depart that far away from the Quran, because the people still read the Quran, they revive words of the Quran, they use it and so on. So it kept these dialects a little bit contained, did not develop into a completely shockingly different language, except in secluded areas like Malta. Maltese is a dialect of Arabic. You if you listen to it, you may catch a few sentences or words which sound like Lebanese dialect, because they are originally from Lebanon and Syria, and they settled there. But because of the break of time, like 500 years separation after Malta fell in the hand of the Crusades, etc., late Crusaders, they lost any refreshing their Arabic with the Quran, with the result that the language now is definitely a separate language. You cannot call it even an Arabic dialect. So these are gone. Until they are gone, essentially in the 4th or the 5th century Hijri, which is something like 1100 Gregorian or Julian calendar, there's nobody to respond to the eloquence. So the arguing with the eloquence, I think the argument is settled, and nobody was able to challenge. So, and the eloquent Arabs are gone. Their judgment has made that they were unable, when they were at utmost enmity, and even people after Islam, many of them are Zanadiqa, secret enemies of Islam, like converted Persians. They tried their best. They did not achieve anything. So that's gone. What other challenges remaining is the intellectual challenge, the scientific challenge, the various aspects of the Quran. And best is really to mention these as we come along from ayah to another ayah, one by one. For example, إِنَّ أَعْطَانِكَ الْكَوْثَرُ صَلِّ رَبِّكَ وَانْحَرْ may have other issues, challenges related to numerology and numeric coincidences and so on, which only became feasible to study in a effective and sensible way after the coming of the computer age. And we mentioned some of the Quranic coincidences and numbers earlier. So the challenge is there still. It's not that the challenge, linguistic part only, but there's many other aspects which has to be all analyzed and brought forward step by step. And some of it will be maybe reserved for the future. We don't have access to it now. So that's, I think that's the, just that I would say this is not really, but it's not for the tafsir to discuss the, what is the meaning of Ijaz al-Quran, what are the various aspects. This is a science by itself, a discipline by itself, and there have been volumes written in that. I just maybe quickly mentioning what I mentioned, I think a couple of halakas ago, is that what Sayyid Qutb Rahimahullah said, that he stressed this called the taswir al-fanni fi al-Quran, the art of drawing with words, what you would be doing if you're drawing with your brush and pencil, if you are drawing with a, and he gave an example of Surah Al-Ghashiyah, Rashi, which I mentioned. So that's another aspect of the miraculous nature of the Quran. So it's not relevant if it is it's intrinsically in the Quran, which I believe it's there, or it is not intrinsically, but Allah undermined everyone attempt, doomed everyone attempt to, if he sits and tries to do respond to the challenge, make him fail. That's also cannot be according to the system of the universe. It's miraculous and by divine intervention. So either way, either by divine initiation in the Quran itself, in the composition, which I am more inclined to, or by divine intervention, by undermining everyone who tried to challenge and making him fail or commit such blunders, become like a joke, a joker, which has happened to many people, expose themselves as jokers. Whatever it is concerning the linguistic part, I think this is nobody responded to the challenge, and nobody will be able to respond to the challenge forever in that part. That's gone and sealed. Now, the challenge is to other aspects, other people to come forward with whatever they can challenge it, and there will be sufficient evidence inside the Quran with available science and technology and knowledge at that time to refute them and show that they are unable to fulfill the challenge, or they become mockery of themselves. Okay, so that's the nature of the challenge of the Quran is very deep and the discipline by itself. So if you cannot respond to the challenge of the Quran and you will never respond, then protect it and embrace faith and accept this messenger and protect yourself from the fire which will be fueled by humans and stones, which has been prepared for the disbeliever. And that's not only the threat, but also there's a good news. وَبَشِّرِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ أَنَّ لَهُمْ جَنَّاتٍ تَجْرِي مِنْ تَحْتِهَا الْأَنْهَارِ. Bring the good news, bring the gospel, that's the gospel, the good news, God's spell, for those who believe and make good deeds. In the Quran, always believe and good deeds. Belief alone is not enough, good deeds. We will discuss the issue of Iman and Amal later, more details. We touched on that at the beginning of Surah Al-Baqarah, but more will come here. That for them allocated are gardens under which rivers flow. When I was small, I was thinking river flow like how can river flow under the gardens? It must be wet and so on. It's not like this. Actually, Nahr is both used for rivers and used also for water supplies in form of tubes. So nowadays we have our cities now are having rivers running underneath there, bringing water and gas, and even you can't call electricity if you want electricity. But there will be not only that, will be other things. Will be milk, unspoiled milk, will be honey coming all in tubes. It's not open river or open canals, it is in tubes. That's the rivers. So river is not only, the translation of river may be misleading, but this is the only word available in Arabic. These supplies with tubes and so on is also called rivers. So it is a running supply, running water, what they call it. This village does not have a running water. Does not mean running water is exposed on the surface. It's running in tubes. So all supplies are coming in. Supplies are plenty and accessible and coming up to your place in whatever kind of supply means, tubes. That's obviously our physical image now. What it will be there, we don't know how it works. كلما رزقوا منها من ثمرة رزق قالوا هذا الذي رزقنا من قبل. Every time they receive a fruit, they say this is the same fruit we received before, but they are surprised. But it's another taste, so the taste keeps changing. There's a, should we call it genetic modification, whatever it is. Every harvest, every years, even every harvest, and every portion of the harvest is having another taste than the other one. Never-ending taste. وأتوا به متشابها. They serve to them, it looks similar to each other, but the taste is different. So every time there's a surprise. And the day you are expecting a surprise, you didn't get a surprise. So, okay, now we are back to the old taste. That again is a surprise. So it is continuously surprising by the same or not the same, but the appearance is the same. And then, since human beings are created man and woman and mates, they have purified mates. What the word purified means, some hadith said there is no menstruation, there is no ejaculation. This is some kind of a relation which is more based on spirituality, spiritual connection. You can call it that. but it could be physical condition of another type, like for example in some movies of Star Trek and Star Wars and things like that. In one of them, other being visited a starship, and these beings are like much more advanced than human, almost like semi-divine. And one married one male being of that specific type married another woman, and all the interaction was just a touch. That's the touch. That's the touch is all what the interaction below the intercourse would have been. Maybe it's like that. No, no. If maybe something which you don't imagine, because in Jannah there will be things which nobody have ever conceived or imagined. So even that what we have, what human imagination on Earth has projected in starships and Star Wars and Star Trek and so on, even beyond that, which we can't imagine now because we have no previous conception of it. But this is the most essential part in this is not only these fruits and these sustenance, but also their spouses, men having women and women having men. They're purified. They don't have whatever in the world, maybe repelling or contaminating. It's pure and this possibly material, spiritual, we don't know. And they are eternal, abiding therein. So that's the reward. So this warning, based on that, don't reject what I told you until you bring me the fulfill the challenge, and you will never fulfill the challenge, so don't waste your energy, but you can do, try, sit and try. Ultimately you will not be able, and ask witnesses, ask other, because that challenge cannot be fulfilled by one person. It needs complete organizations, universities, even these will fail. So don't waste your time. But if you do it, then you will recognize. If you try it, you will recognize immediately you will fail from the outset. So protect yourself from the hellfire, because that should prove that you this is really our messenger, and this is really our words and our ayats. And if you comply, it's not you are escaping the hellfire only. You are getting much more than that. You are getting paradises, you're getting gardens and which river flows, and you will having spouses which are purified, and you are eternally there. There's no death anymore. I think we stop here, because after that it will go to another main topic. And I think that this is ayah 24 in this count, or 25 in the other count of Hafs. Okay, that's enough.